Hey folks, Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman here. Thank you for being members of the Cafe Insider community.
This is Backstage, a special segment of the Now and Then podcast exclusively for you. We hope you enjoy it.
So obviously this whole topic absolutely fascinates me. And one of the reasons that I care as deeply about it as I do is because it is part of one of the real formative moments in my career. And I would say in my life, in that, you know, when you go to conferences, you go out with friends and you go to lunches and you talk to people. And I was a very young scholar, a very new scholar, and very into, I think it was my second book, which is about Reconstruction. And I was still what I would call naive, thinking that what you needed to do was to be nice to everybody, and then the world would be a happy place, which is going to sound funny after having just recorded this episode. And I went out to lunch with a number of scholars, including Charles Joyner, known as Chaz Joyner, who was a great scholar of Reconstruction, who had a PhD in American history and also one in folklore and mythology, and was just a really nice guy, you know, really sort of avuncular. And I asked him, I was kind of nervous and making conversation, and I asked him, I remember we were walking away from the table and there was a brick wall behind him. I still have it in my head. And I said to him, so Chaz, what do you think would have made Reconstruction different? And he said, the United States government should have taken 1,500 of the top Confederates out and lined them up against a wall and shot them. And I started laughing because I thought he was kidding. And he did not crack a smile, and he said, I am dead serious, because what the mistake they made is they never made treason odious. And the minute that you had made there be a cost for continuing to be a Confederate, lots of people who were fellow travelers, if you will, would never have gone that way. They would have cozied up to the government, the United States government, rather than to the Confederate ideology, in the same way that you were talking about with the Loyalists and the Colonials when the British came and went. And I remember sort of in a way recoiling and thinking, what a horrible way to look at the world. And as I say, I was young and naive, because the older I got and the more I watched how you change political conversations, the stronger it has come clear to me that actually taking a stand that is legal but also moral is incredibly important. So by the time you get, for example, to Watergate, and Nixon essentially walks from Watergate, and I had this conversation within the last 2 years with people who are active now in journalism, and they're like, oh, that was the right thing to do. And I was like, no, it was not. Because if Nixon had at least gone to trial, I don't care if he was convicted or not, depending on what the evidence was, we never heard it in a court of law, it would have made it so that people following him would have recognized that that's a line that you couldn't cross. And I don't think we would have gotten Iran-Contra. I don't think we would have gotten weapons of mass destruction. And I do not think we would have gotten the election of Donald Trump. So there is this sense that being nice and kind seems in the short term like the easy way to go. But in the long term, it can be deadly.
That brings us back to some of what we just talked about in the episode, which is, of course, bound up in that, is the question of what kind of nation is this new regime or this new version of the old government going to be? So if indeed, and certainly that's a line-drawing moment, if you line people up and shoot them down, that's a strong statement being made. There is a line, but it makes a very strong statement about what kind of nation this new nation is going to be in. Not necessarily a positive way, right? So it can breed bad things as well as good things. So it's complicated.
Well, mind you, I'm not endorsing that. And one of the big differences between East Germany and West Germany after World War II is that East Germany did line people up against a wall and shoot them, and they got rid of the rule of law.
Well, exactly.
Whereas West Germany went ahead and actually worked through the legal system, and a lot of people got off, but they reinforced the idea of the rule of law. But I think that what interests me, and one of the reasons I have a hard time now with what we're doing with the insurrectionists of January, is that a lot of people are making the case that what we really need to do is be understanding and to try and reintegrate people. And I look at that and I see the Reconstruction period and recognize that I'd love to think that being nice brings people around, but the reality is there are a lot of people for whom it doesn't. And that's one of the reasons I was so interested in the revolution, is because it is really glaring to me that we don't end up in America after the revolution with people running around going, we should be British, we should be British. And I don't really yet, I think, fully understand why that's the case.
Well, I think there are a lot of ways you could answer that question. I think one of them is that the United States very much takes a stand as being the new world versus the old world and representing things that are better and more virtuous than what was in the old world and monarchy. And it's easy to take that stand. It's not necessarily easy to stand behind it. But the United States is very good at depicting itself as a new thing and a more virtuous thing in the world. And so I think that actually that's interesting. That's a cultural angle that probably helps that moment to make it a little bit more difficult for loyalists to say, I just want to go back to what we had. The answer to that could be, well, then go.
But, you know? But maybe that's it. Maybe it's partly that they leave. At least a number of them leave because, in fact, during Reconstruction, the same thing was said in America and said about America, that this was going to be this great new moment and we were going to have this new Trans-Pacific partnership with Asia and we're going to leave the old world behind and look, we've
And there's a power to that kind of cultural statement. And what's interesting about this to me throughout this episode and in a bunch of the other ones we've done too is the vital importance of the public dimension of what we're talking about here. Because we talk about punishments and we talk about accountability, but in the end, in one way or another, what we're talking about is the public, the American public being aware of these determinations and actions and punishments and decisions and limitations. What matters more than anything else in a democratic republic is public opinion. Public opinion is what gives people power. Public opinion is what takes it away. And if you're going to do something under the rule of law that's democratic, you're going to need to incorporate public opinion. And thus, public commissions are important, and these kinds of actions that will have a strong play become important. It's interesting, in the founding era, there was a lot of anxiety about being too firm or strong or aggressive in actions that the government took, because the fear was that it would alienate Americans who still hadn't fully accepted this new government. And there's a newspaper that says a really interesting thing about government in a democratic republic. It says, in one way or another, government in a republic is government by sleight of hand, meaning you have to sort of figure out the way to do things to communicate to the public what needs to be communicated without necessarily bringing down the hammer of force in a way that's going to change what people fundamentally think of the government itself.
Well, which brings up the control of the media. You know, so what matters is public opinion, but the question is, how do you shape public opinion? And that, of course, in Reconstruction, is it's being shaped largely coming out of the South by former Confederates, you know, the newspaper men of the time, because you get the new national wire services rising after the war. As I say, this is both the moral angle and the legal angle strike me as being central, as you say, to what America is and should be.
But they can't exist in isolation, right? There needs to be a combination of things that, as the 18th century would have put it, a nice calculation, you know, the kind of precise calculation that has force but is not immoral.
And yet for me, and I wonder if you feel the same, it is absolutely bizarre to be living through a period that mirrors one that I have spent my life studying. Because it's real easy to sit here and say, oh, Thaddeus Stevens was right on this and wrong on this. And oh, Grant was right on this and wrong on this. It's a very different thing to be reading the news every single day and being like, ah, crap, you know, this is kind of threading the needle. And you can see why it was hard for people at the time, but it also makes you recognize how incredibly hard it is for people today.
I had the same experience, and it reveals how easy it is to move to a place you're not aware that you could move to. So when I was writing about Southern violence against Northerners in Congress, and I was writing about Northerners not fighting back, Northerners, you know, absorbing it and asking for rule changes. And at the time I was doing that, sometimes I would have the TV on, blurbing happily in the background. And I remember once, as I'm writing and as I'm thinking about writing, I look up and I say to the TV set, damn you, just fight, like fight back. And I out loud to the TV, right? And then I was like, You know, like that, I didn't expect that to come out of my mouth. I didn't mean like grab a weapon and run, but it was like this guttural cry, like fight back. You have to be aggressive in a way that I didn't know was inside me and which immediately resonated with what I was writing in my book. I understood the people watching these Northerners in Congress so much better when they were crying for them to do something to fight back, even though it might seem more aggressive or nastier than they were used to behaving. It's an emotional pull that it's easy to overlook until you get pulled by it.
And yet you wonder if a similar thing is starting to manifest itself in modern day politics, because I know exactly what you're talking about. When Anson Burlingame from Massachusetts stands up on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1856 and says, "We will fight. You just beat up Charles Sumner, and we're not going to play nice any longer. Stop bullying us," essentially. And you see this again and again and again on Twitter, on social media, people saying, "Why don't the Democrats fight?" And even
you're seeing it with the vaccines too, right? With the people who've gotten vaccinated are suddenly like, you know what? Screw them. Like these people who want, like there's an anger and a desire to just sort of say, that's it, that wasn't there. And there was and has been for a very long time, the sort of, well, we need to explain things. We can't make people feel bad. And it's certainly judging from social media, which is not always a great place to judge things from, there's more anger there and more, again, line drawing than I saw in the past. Thank you for joining us backstage.
Be sure to write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com. See you next time.